Twice this summer, President Trump has issued warnings of weekend raids targeting migrants from Central America with deportation orders. The first raid, announced in June, was apparently called off. The second was expected last Sunday. Here's Acting U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Director Ken Cuccinelli speaking to reporters at the White House earlier that week.
They're absolutely going to happen. There's approximately a million people in this country with removal orders.
Well, the raids don't appear to have happened after all. What did happen were protests in cities all over the country, including Kansas City, as people in immigrant communities prepared for what they thought might be, what, an abrupt end to their time in the U.S., a possible separation of their families, maybe a need to prove that they are here legally should they get caught up in the mix with friends and neighbors. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're asking how threats of immigration raids have affected local communities in recent weeks. Call 816-235-2888. If you've changed how you live your life because of this, what's changed and why? 816-235-2888. We especially want to hear from immigrants, but even if you're not an immigrant, if this is having an impact on you and your life, we want to hear about it. 816-235-2888. Let's start with two guests who work closely with Spanish-speaking immigrants in particular, immigration lawyer Angela Ferguson. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Celia Calderon Ruiz, a lifelong Kansas Cityan, so not an immigrant, but part of an immigrant family and a Spanish speaker and longtime community organizer. Hi, Celia.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
What kinds of things are you two hearing from folks right now?
So, we talked a little bit about anxiety. There's definitely a lot of anxiety, but I'd say that it's definitely being built upon by social media posts. And depending on what type of access, you know, we have, but I'd say that the words that keep sticking out to me is just in case. For a lot of people and for a lot of families, it's I'll share this post just in case.
Share what kind of posts?
Unconfirmed. I would say unconfirmed reportings of ICE or Immigration Customs Enforcement. And so then it could be a vehicle that's parked or it could look suspicious or very well-intentioned people saying, I think I saw this. I heard it could be. And they absolutely become viral posts.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of those, I think.
Yeah, and so then that adds to the anxiety, that creates the anxiety.
So you're hearing just in case.
Just in case I'll share this. Just in case for those that I love. Just in case I won't go out. Just in case and just to be safe. And that is a very anxious way to live.
Angela, what about you?
Certainly hearing the same thing. We have just been inundated with folks asking for Know Your Rights presentations for...
people actively reaching out to you.
Absolutely. And I would commend the Kansas City Public Library. They're providing Know Your Rights trainings for folks through the Advocates for Immigrant Rights. They're presenting at the public libraries. They're making sure that those resources are available. There are several community groups in town that are reaching out and trying to keep the community calm, but also help them protect themselves.
Who is reaching out to you specifically, and what are the kinds of questions they have about status issues, about rights?
Oh, it's a wide variety, but things like I need to get a power of attorney so that I have someone appointed to take care of my children just in case. What do I do with my property just in case I'm picked up? How is it handled? How do I distribute or get rid of it? Houses, you know, cars, things like that. Emergency questions. What do I do about transportation for my kids? How do I get passports for the children that I'm going to be taking back with me who are U.S. citizens? How do I get them quick? So it's really trying to advise people to be prepared just in case it happens.
When you talk about rights, I think that a lot of people might be under the impression that undocumented immigrants maybe don't have a lot of rights. What would you say to that?
They are protected by our Constitution, just like you and I. It's important for them to know that they have the right against unlawful search and seizure. They have the right not to let ICE into their homes, not to let law enforcement into their homes if they do not have a warrant for arrest for the correct person signed by a judge. And that is so critical.
You emphasize correct person and signed by a judge. So I want you to spell out the emphasis on both of those counts.
So routinely, we will hear stories about immigration coming to a door and showing a piece of paper with a photograph of a person, right? This person live at this house? No, we don't know that person. Can we just come in and talk to you about this is a dangerous person that we hear is, you know, was at this house or lived in this neighborhood. Can we come in and talk? If you let them in, that's the ruse that they use to get in to arrest anyone that is there in the house undocumented. The search warrant or arrest warrant has to have the correct name, the correct address, and be signed by a judge. So it's important to look at the document. And if you are having someone standing on your door demanding entrance, you need to ask them to show you. You need to have a way to see that document. Either put it under the door, have a chain on the door, hold it up to a window. You need to read the document before you open that door.
So are you urging people to do things like putting chains on their doors so they can do this?
Absolutely. AIR in their emergency packet actually provides chains for families to install.
I'm trying to imagine myself in this position, someone in an authoritative position in a uniform, perhaps with some, I don't know if people are armed when they come to doors or not. I just don't know. I've never been in that situation. But I'm trying to imagine myself informing that person that I know that my right is for them to not enter and trying to tell them to go away. That requires something personal, you know, like an internal kind of like strength that I don't know if I could muster in that situation.
That's right. Courage, you know, and a good understanding of what your rights are in the United States. And I think it takes practice. So when we hold Know Your Rights trainings, we try to get people to stand up and practice this with each other. Law enforcement is trained to get that door open. So if someone cracks the door, they will try to step in. They will get that foot in the door and count that as consent.
Celia, jump in here.
Yeah, and I want to put another perspective to this. You know, I've been to plenty of Know Your Rights trainings, which are very well received, and I've seen families share them amongst each other, amongst text messages. People are grabbing onto the information. But I really want us to visualize what it looks like and there's door hangers that I love that say, hey, these are your rights. Remember, before you open the door, blank, blank, blank. But I'll be honest, I put that on my door just, and this is helpful for anyone. It doesn't matter what our status is. And so then I put it on my door, and so then I kept it on for a couple of days, and I thought, man, how tough it is to leave my house and have to look at this reminder every single day. Me as an adult, and we talked about courage, think about young children that are opening up the door. Think about teenagers. You know, if it takes courage and practice that we have to work on as 40, 50, 60-year-olds, 30-year-olds, what are parents telling their children? And they are. And so then let's think about those young people who are faced with the same adult situations. And I think about, you know, for many of us, we were the young interpreters in the household. We were exposed to adult conversations at a very young age. Think about everything that we're talking about today and will talk about. And then imagine a 14, 13, 12, 10-year-old having to process all of this.
Can you talk to me a little bit more about seeing the door hanger that is your reminder for here's what I can say if someone knocks on my door demanding entry in some kind of immigration raid, but how seeing that door hanger affects you as you walk out into the world?
So I took it down. I took it down, but I hung it up because I thought I'm working with these folks, worked with AIR and some other groups, and I'm handing out this, you know, the same information. I thought if I'm giving them this, I have to be able to practice the same way. So then I hung it up. It was up about 3 days, and I can't cuss on the radio. But I was like, oh man, I can't look at this. I can't walk out and have a productive day. And again, I am very fortunate to be in a safe space, but I can't walk out of my house and feel productive and happy and, you know, go do my regular day job and have to think about immigration, attorney, no, open, don't open, and all of that guidance there. So it's tough. And I took it down and I was like, so we can give guidance, but we have to realize how real this is for so many families every day.
Celia, I'm curious from your perspective whether it is just people whose statuses are up in the air who are concerned right now, or are local immigrant communities more generally wrapped up in the anxiety, whether they have documentation or not?
Well, I think one of the words, and I hope everyone will remember the words of mixed status. You know, it's very difficult to find a family where everyone in their entire, circle of loved ones is completely, you know, with a documented status or without an undocumented status. So you will have people that are absolutely, you know, in legal status and are very worried about their loved ones. And I think that's where I've seen like a lot of text messages go out just to everyone saying, hey, just in case if you know anyone. And mixed status means that, you know, it's not always going to be a citizen. You can have a legal permanent resident. You can have all of these legal statuses. But if you want to think about 100% American U.S. citizen in whatever image that people or listeners may have in their mind, that person is also very worried about what's happening.
Can you explain why?
They love people. They love people, whether they know them or not. I've seen people that are not of an immigrant background. I've seen black and brown and browner and white and whiter saying, oh my gosh, this is not fair. And we know you as people, or we don't know you as people, and this is not right.
Angela, you know, I understand that the people expected to be targeted by these anticipated raids, possible raids, are groups that would have essentially been left alone by previous administrations who tended to go specifically after folks with criminal records, right? Or am I misunderstanding that?
Well, that's correct. Under the previous administration, they prioritized criminals, and the second priority was people with prior deportation orders. So this announced raid is supposed to sweep up the folks that have recent deportation orders, the recent arrivals.
It's
interesting. That's a problem.
Yeah, I'm curious about what is specific or maybe new about the idea of a raid targeting recent arrivals.
I think they're trying to use it as a deterrent to get these folks to quit coming. Say, if you are lucky enough to be released into the United States, we're going to order you deported and sweep you up and get you out of here. And so it doesn't pay to travel to that border and seek asylum.
So it's like the setting an example kind of thing.
Right. But the problem is that the system is so broken that many of these people have deportation orders maybe that they don't know about. They didn't have legal representation. They didn't know that their court date was changed or location was changed.
Can you explain how a person has deportation orders that they don't know about?
Sure. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you one I met this past week. A 10-year-old girl who was brought to the border and turned in. And she was placed in a foster care system, transferred from El Paso to New York City, kept in a foster home for 5 months, and received counseling because she'd been through horrible stuff, and then just released to her grandpa in Missouri. A grandpa has an A number for this little girl, and he has a packet of papers that they gave him that has her case number on it. And you can call the court system, their 800 number, to try to find out your court date. And it tells the court date it doesn't have a location. She has no idea. This family has no idea where to take her to court. Well, that means they have to hire a lawyer to try and find out. It's possible. But people have, the system is not working. Mail doesn't arrive. Their hearing notices don't arrive. They're issued deportation notices to come to court that say to be determined and the time and the location to be determined. If they never get the notice of when to go to court, they get in absentia deportation orders for failing to appear at a place they don't know about.
What are you telling people right now? I mean, we heard some of it. Is there is there sort of like a simple kind of guidance that you give in the absence of being able to have a more thorough conversation? Are there sort of like what you would call the basics?
Yeah, the basics. One, review your case with an immigration attorney. Stay on top of it. Check that 800 number as often as you can if you are in deportation proceedings. Learn what your rights are and carry a rights card in your wallet so you can tell an officer that you want to remain silent or you want to talk to your lawyer. Make sure to be saving money for a bond in case you are swept up and you're bond eligible. Make sure to call someone that is legal so you let them know where you're at, where you're being detained.
Celia, you have created a workbook.
Yes. So it's in Spanish, so it's called Cuidémonos, and Cuidémonos means let's take care of ourselves. And so then it was just a very simple but I would say quick response to the elections where the ideas were all of this, you know, that these threatened raids and, you know, everything would happen, you know, January 20th. And so then I try to be a very positive person. And so then the idea was let's have those conversations of being prepared. And so then one of the, well, so this is available online. Families can download it, print it. There are agencies that are using it here locally as they do their Know Your Rights trainings. But it's about 20 pages, and it says, you know, write down your name, your A number, your date of birth. You know, do you have an open case? You know, are you legally married? What's your date of birth? And this is helpful for anyone outside. So, I mean, as we're listening to this, think about how it could also apply in your life. But, you know, if I were to be detained, you know, before I'm deported, you know, would someone know how to identify me? Because someone might just know me by my nickname, may not know my exact date of birth. You know, do I take medications? You know, have I filled out my powers of attorney? And instead of just having all of these ideas, you know, thought up in my head, have I actually told someone, my loved one, hey, if I weren't to be here, I'm a kick butt, you know, chef. And, you know, if I go back to my country, I want you to, you know, take, you know, I don't know what kind of equipment I invested in. I have a restaurant here. And so then go take my stuff down because I am going to be a kick butt person down there too.
You know? Make plans to get you what you need.
Correct. Instead of reacting in the moment and, you know, sometimes, you know, someone can become, you know, a hashtag, you know, and you know, a social movement. You know, and what if I were to say, you know what, don't make Celia a social movement. You know, if Celia wants to leave, Celia got her stuff and she got her plan and she's going to leave and she's good. Because, and I'm looking over at Angela, they saved, you know, we saved money. And I decided, you know, this is the attorney I'm going to go with. And you know, I've heard from families say, if I were to be picked up, don't give this country any more money. Okay, because they're going to kick me out anyway. So I prefer to have my money back in my country. I've heard other people say, you know what, if they were to pick me up, I am not leaving because I have been here 40 plus years. So don't think about immigrants just getting here within the last 5 years. People have been here decades. So I've been here the past 40 years. You know, I'm not leaving and I'm going to fight this. And then there is save your money. Save your money because there are attorneys, there are fees. You know, this will go on for a long time. So the idea behind the book is to really put a positive spin where I can take control of what I want for myself and my family.
And it sounds like when you talk about don't make someone a hashtag if they don't want to be, for example, like you're also talking about not just controlling your life, but you're controlling your narrative.
Correct. Yeah. Controlling a narrative, controlling your exposure. And, you know, I had a conversation once with a mom where she had an encounter with ICE. And so then she called a phone number, and it wasn't local. It was actually one of the national numbers to report. I saw an ICE sighting, blank happened. And so then, you know, whatever, they had picked someone up that she knew. And she said, oh my gosh, what do I do? Because they said that, you know, they can help me create, like, I don't know, something about online and, like, probably something like a GoFundMe or something. And I don't know, what do I tell them? I'm like, oh man, lady, like, I wish, like, someone would explain. And there's awesome, you know, people and good intentions and good strategies, but everyone has the choice and the dignity to say, this is what I want for my family. And sometimes it's a national story and sometimes it's not.
Well, we will be taking your calls and hearing your stories after the break. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I've been talking with immigration lawyer Angela Ferguson and community volunteer Celia Calderon Ruiz. Hi again, you guys.
Hello.
I want to talk now with someone who lived many years undocumented. He's got legal status now, Kansas City artist and curator Israel Garcia, and he's going to share his story. You can still share yours at 816-235-2888. Hi, Israel.
Hello.
We have spoken before, so I know a lot about your story. It's got really wild twists and turns, but basically your parents brought you to the U.S. when you were, what, seven?
Correct.
Yeah, and your mom got legal status eventually, but even though your family spent most of your childhood documenting your journey, trying to get you asylum, you kept hitting bureaucratic roadblocks. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, listening to Angela and Celia, it's coming to realize, and I think I knew this, but I think it's listening to them where you begin to realize that there are, you know, 13 million plus stories out there that are very individualized, that are very much like mine or maybe not even like mine. But yeah, I think my story, my mom came to the U.S. as a farm worker, and it's through that thread that we were able to begin, or she was able to begin, the immigration process for us.
You lived in the shadows for a very long time before finding out that you actually had succeeded in getting papers, but they had never been sent to you. They were sitting in a box in a basement somewhere for, what, 10 years?
Yeah, correct. It's a very interesting story, and every time I tell it, I even surprise myself that that is, you know, my story. And I think Angela was talking about a broken system, and I think I'm definitely a good example of that, and able to talk about it ultimately.
So you did, though, over the course of those 10 years, you have that feeling of fear of being deported.
Yeah, there is, because you don't understand, I think, when you're a child or when you're young, as Celia was talking about, you know, there is a certain point, at least when the time that I was growing up, where you didn't really understand the situation, didn't really understand what status was or what it is that your parents were working on. You know, you understood, in our case, we were growing up in LA and we were amongst a community where you didn't really know. And I think I really didn't know the extent of our status or an understanding until you had to get that first job or you had to start applying to school or universities.
It sounds to me like probably a younger generation doesn't have that same sort of not talking about it from what I'm hearing in this conversation so far. Like, it sounds like it's something people are very much talking about now.
Yeah, no, I think the conversation has completely changed. I think there was it's to be said that, you know, it's a different time frame, and it's definitely a 360. You know, there's conversations that I think now as an adult, I think back at my me growing up in LA and begin to kind of put those puzzle pieces together where at the time I didn't understand. But now as an adult, thinking back of what my parents were going through or what my mom had gone through, it's a better understanding of my own story, which I wasn't grasping at the time.
When you hear threats of immigration raids, what goes through your mind as someone who has had that sense of this could apply to me?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, for myself at least, I don't think it ever, the anxiety or the fear ever goes away. You know, you've kind of in some way have lived with this trauma 35 plus years. And I speak about my own, that it's going to take me at least that long to get a handle of it or over it, you know.
How long have you had legal status that you have known about?
Yeah, I mean, I just became a U.S. citizen in 2018. But before then, I was a U.S. resident. And like I said, I think knowingly, as far as and it's tricky because I always knew I had some sort of status because, you know, I had my Social Security card. I had it had been worked through since high school. So I think I always knew there was something there. I just didn't understand what it was or what it wasn't. Like I said, my mom and her various efforts of applying for what would be a permanent residency really happened, I think, here in Kansas City, I think, back in the early 90s.
So when you talk about that you still feel some anxiety and trauma when you hear threats of raids, that's as someone with citizenship.
It is. I don't think it ever goes away, that fear. And I think, as Celia mentioned, not even for yourself, but for your community, because we are all in a circle of loved ones where it's unknown. You know, their status is unknown. And I think we love them enough to care and have that empathy for their experience and for their narrative that may be different than ours, but it's still a parallel issue.
Angela, this story does get back somewhat to the story that you were telling about a girl who doesn't know. She doesn't know where she's supposed to go to court. There's information that gets lost. It sounds like a thread of communication that has many points of possible rupture in it. Are there other stories of people in Kansas City right now who are uncertain of how a raid might apply to them, of what their fate would be, of whether they, of what their status is?
Well, sure. But I guess what I'm concerned about is people staying calm, right, and being prepared. People that know that they have a court process going on need to stay on top of their case, call the 800 number, review their case with an immigration lawyer and make sure that they know what's going to happen, right? And be prepared no matter what their decision is, if they choose to stay or choose to fight to the bitter end. People who have deportation orders, if they know that, they need to review to see if there's some way to get it reopened, to start their case over, to do it right. Because sometimes they have not been properly represented. Sometimes they didn't get notice, the mail didn't arrive, and there's a possibility of reopening that case. So it's just something to educate themselves about so they can make proper decisions before that knock on the door happens. Now, we're talking about raids not happening here in Kansas City, but we have ICE officers here, and they are constantly doing their job. It's just you don't know where they are going to appear, and that's one reason people need to be prepared. And folks like Israel and Celia, just because they're citizens, you know, we have heard stories about local courts, traffic court and domestic violence court. If the name sounds Hispanic, there sometimes the courts are calling immigration to be present, to pick up at traffic court. And, you know, it's very concerning. And people then don't show up for their court appearances.
You know, you mentioned when you were describing ICE officers in Kansas City that they're here doing their job. Those are the words you used. And you've also talked about how people in Kansas City who are immigrants of varying statuses all have some degree of rights, and that you're working to educate people on what those are. How would you see ICE officers, like, could you paint the picture of ICE officers doing their job and people's rights being respected, what that either does or would look like?
Well, I guess the ICE officers who have valid warrants, that are signed by the court, by a judge, need to execute those warrants. And if they appear at the proper address and they identify the person properly and they have a final order of deportation, they should be picked up. They may be able to reopen their case or defend, file a stay of removal or something like that to defend, but that's ICE properly doing their jobs. What we're hearing and seeing is ICE officers trolling. The courtroom hallways, courthouse hallways, and looking for people that may be appearing for minor traffic violations, things like that, I think are maybe inappropriate. They don't have warrants to pick people up sometimes, and they do. They're racial profiling, of course. The ICE officers are busy, but we do not want people to just be living in fear. We want them to be prepared.
You know, Celia, you talked about at the beginning of our conversation about the phrase just in case. What are some of the scenarios that you hear being very common that people are making a just in case plan for? And can you talk a little bit about that? About how people are living with this just-in-case mind frame.
Well, I'll share that the just-in-case, what it looks like specifically, I can think of online. So the online post, I think I saw something, this may be it. And so then that's shared. And then it's shared by other people in other circles. I mean, it's online. And so when that reaches other people, and so then that becomes, you know, don't go to blank area. You know, not even today. Not even tomorrow. You know, well, they were there last week, you know, and so then it becomes this.
A whole, like, maybe a whole municipality even.
It could be, yeah. Because, and so then, and then even, and even if it's, it could be a completely incorrect reporting, and I'm not saying yes or no. I think sometimes what happens with the images of an ICE raid, I think we think about what we see on TV. And so then thinking that they're going to storm in a place and, you know, they're dressed in SWAT clothing. And it's, you know, as Angela mentioned, it's not always going to look like that. It could be in different places. And, you know, it could be a smaller amount of officers. And so then I think that image is implanted. And so then it attaches to a municipality. It attaches to a neighborhood. It attaches to, you know, a certain time of the day. And so then let's just kind of avoid this just in case. You know, and so then what that could manifest into, and it has, I heard from a clinic that said that they had no-shows. No-shows meaning not showing up for appointments.
And health clinic?
Correct, yeah. This a weekend where there was a threat of raids. And so then after some brainstorming, I was like, oh, yeah, that's the threat out that's out this weekend. And it's not the only weekend. I mean, there's going to be other weekends, and there have been other weekends where neighborhoods, I remember years ago out in Northeast, no one went to church. No one went to church. No one went to the grocery stores, and everything was dead. And I remember telling myself, I was like, I can't, I'll go out or whatever. And I was like, I'm going to go see what it looks like. And I drove around, and it was a ghost town. So it can look like that. It can look like that in, you know, places that we should be going. You know, it could look like, you know, maybe let someone else can drive as I go to blank area, you know, because I don't want to be driving. Yeah, so that's what it can look like. And preparing for it means having the conversations beforehand and actually making a plan for the day.
Celia Calderon Ruiz, thank you so much for talking to us today. And Angela Ferguson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Israel Garcia, it's been good having you. Thanks so much.
Thanks again.
Keep talking to us about how threats of ICE raids are affecting you and your communities on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. Up next, special suits for exploring volcanoes that are made in Missouri. Stay tuned. We're going to start this next segment with a clip from Family Guy.
Perhaps you'd be interested in something every homeowner cannot be without: volcano insurance.
Peter, of course, falls for the sales pitch, though he has one shining moment of skepticism.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure we've never had a volcano either.
Well, don't you think we're overdue for one?
I'm Gina Kaufman, and the line about how we haven't had a volcano around here popped into my head this morning as I thought about our next guest. She's an MU student who designed a special suit that you can wear to study volcanoes, a breathable lava suit. Abby Romine, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Jenna.
What inspired you to design clothing that you can wear like around and in volcanoes?
Actually, the geology department here at Mizzou approached the textile and apparel management department, and it kind of just came to me by email. They were asking if anybody was interested in designing volcano pants. Sounded kind of silly at first, but I was like, outdoor apparel, that's my alley. So I jumped on the idea.
Okay, I want to get back to why that's your alley later. But for now, just the phrase breathable lava suit needs some parsing. Start with breathable. Why does a suit worn into a volcano need to breathe?
Well, hopefully they're not actually wearing it into the volcano. So actually, from what I've gotten for participants from my research, they do a lot of hiking to collect samples around volcanoes. So they needed
that makes more sense.
Correct. They needed rugged outdoor apparel. They do come within, close proximity of lava flow. But these outfits are kind of something that you can wear every day, but also for those strenuous moments, they are protective garment systems.
Okay, so now the lava part, and you've gotten to this, but I get that people who study volcanoes might come into proximity with lava, like you've said, but everything that I personally know about lava comes from childhood games where the lava was totally imaginary. As long as you jumped from one couch to another, you were safe. I would not know the first thing about what I need to take into consideration if I'm close to real lava. Can you walk me through some of that?
Well, I actually had no idea either. I had been to Mount Etna in Sicily, and I thought it was crazy that people were getting that close to lava flow at their own will. But just talking to Dr. Alan Whittington and other members of the geology department, they spoke about kind of using the rock hammers and collecting samples near lava flow. Sometimes it's an active lava flow, but also sometimes it's inactive. So it's not all necessarily going to be hot samples, I guess, that they're collecting. But I forgot where I was going.
No,
with
but
that,
like, why do you need a special? What is it that the suit needs to be able to do for you if you're near lava?
So it's flame retardant. So if you are within close proximity of high temperatures, you risk your apparel melting. So depending upon the materials that you are wearing, it can protect your hair from singeing or something on your body. But just mainly that discomfort that you feel when you're close to heat. This is kind of that portable environment that you wear in strenuous areas.
I want to talk to someone else now because I had originally really, 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 really wanted to wear a lava suit so that I could give our listeners a personal review, a firsthand review, which is the only kind I trust. But that turned out not to be possible. So I'm going to turn to someone who has worn one of these. Well, okay, he has not tested the whole suit, I should say, but he has tested the pants.
Yes.
Alan Whittington, MU geologist. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, I know you have more to say than just this, but out of the gate, give me your review. How were the pants out in the field?
Oh, they're awesome. They're lightweight, very comfortable. They have things in the right places. So this is something we talked with Abby about quite a lot. We carry a lot of gear with us, and our pants are not only protection for our legs, but they're also an extension of our backpacks. We're carrying all kinds of compasses and notebooks, and often we'll carry a hammer on the pants as well. So the placement of everything so it doesn't just like chafe and bruise you throughout the day is really important.
So you're like trying to turn your body into a garage wall.
Yeah, pretty much. That's right. I mean, we prefer to think of ourselves as like, you know, it's like Batman's utility belt, but a garage wall is probably more accurate.
How hard hard has it been to find clothing that allows you to do the kind of work you do in reasonable comfort? Can you share some of your, like, outdoorsman geologist fashion history?
Yeah, so it's actually surprisingly hard. So, you know, what we really need is a combination of, like, really nice outdoor gear, which is usually very breathable, but often not particularly durable. And then on the other hand, you've got kind of, you know, work gear like carpenter jeans, things like that, which are usually very durable, although I found that there are particular places that I tend to wear through them very quickly. I guess I must spend a lot of time sitting on sharp rocks or something. But they're not very comfortable to hike long distances, you know, carrying heavy weights and sweating a lot. So it's that combination. And then the third aspect is also the flame retardant. Now, I haven't got to test these sampling active lava flows yet. But, you know, I was telling Abby when we were talking through the design, I have a particularly strong memory of sampling a lava flow in Guatemala that was it was flowing. It's extremely hot. You know, it's about 2200 Fahrenheit. So, you know, you just can't get that close to it. You start to lose the hair off your, you know, hands and your eyebrows and stuff. And there's a photo of me and one of my Guatemalan colleagues in front of the lava flow. And we're both kind of smiling and doing the thumbs up. And I remember we managed to hold that pose all of about a second because I was really worried that my back was going to catch fire. Because I was wearing, you know, like nylon.
And you're like smiling for a photo while you're like, there's a chance my back is going to catch on fire.
We're all kind of vain. So, yeah, we can hold that pose for a second. But, yeah, I mean, my shirt got so hot. I mean, it was really painful to touch. And my back really felt like it was burning as well.
I've got to say, 2200 Fahrenheit does put this, like, heat spell we're having in perspective for me. So thank you for that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a whole different level. Yep.
So you actually developed a wish list for this suit. What have we not talked about yet that is on this wish list that Abby worked with?
So I would say one of the really important things, actually, is Abby talked not only with me, but with many of my students. And the original idea for this came about when I was working with a PhD student on a different volcano in Guatemala. Genevieve Robert, who's now a professor at Bates College in Maine, we were hiking over Fuego and to take our mind off the fairly hazardous situation we were in, we started, you know, just compiling a gripe list about how uncomfortable, you know, our clothes were making us. And so the really cool thing is that Abby talked to, I've had both male and but also a lot of female students. You know, the needs and so on are slightly different. And also, of course, the first thing is just all the pockets, which is, you know, something that the women don't usually get in their other clothes and are extremely appreciated.
Yeah, Abby, I think that there's a market beyond volcanologists for pants with usable pockets that can be worn by women.
Yes, and I think that based on, like, the user-centered design approach, the feedback, because I had a first prototype, and then Alan and a few other students were able to see those prototypes, and they were like, this pocket needs to be higher, this needs to be bigger for field notebooks, everything. So just that, user-centered design approach is basically what made it, the second prototype, that much more functional.
Alan, I'm going to let you go in just a moment. I can't help but ask you before you go, why do you go to volcanoes? Like, why is that the thing you do?
Well, I go to volcanoes because that's where the lava is the glib answer. But I've always just been really interested in mountains and magma. And so, you know, not all volcanoes are mountains and not all mountains contain magma, but those are the two things I've always found really fascinating. So
that's
our research actually, yeah, it's mostly experiments in the lab, actually. We do a lot of, we have these high-temperature furnaces. We melt lava in the lab and measure its properties and how fast it can flow. So kind of the long-term goal is to understand hazards associated with lava flows and then also how and why volcanoes change from lava flows to exploding. So the volcano that we were on when I felt my back was burning, Pacaya, that actually had a fairly, has had several fairly major explosive eruptions. But this happens in the middle of what seems to be a gentle eruption producing lava flows. It's actually doing the same thing at this moment.
Whoa.
It started erupting again about a week ago.
I feel like, did you hear the clip from Family Guy about volcano insurance?
I did, yes, yes.
Is that like, so to you, like, that's not so ridiculous. Maybe if you live in Rhode Island, but like, volcanoes?
So, well, I mean, in Missouri, probably not something you need to worry about. Of course, southeast Missouri around, you know, Johnson Shuttons and Elephant Rock State Park, 1,400 million years ago, that looked rather like Yellowstone does today, except without the plants, because they weren't around then. But yeah, there would be very, very large super volcanoes in southeast Missouri.
Super volcanoes.
Yeah.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, it's an awesome place. You know, the geology of southeast Missouri is fascinating and very well exposed. But that was 1.4 billion years ago, which is almost a third of the age of the Earth. So
yeah.
There hasn't really been a whole lot. There have been a few little things since then. But yeah, I used to have earthquake insurance on my house. Not that I really thought I needed it, but it was more of a just in case. It would be so embarrassing for a geologist to be caught without it. But I've never worried about volcano insurance.
Well, thank you. Alan Whittington, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Abby, you've said that you have been to a volcano, and I want to talk a little bit about your background, too. I understand that you are an Army veteran.
Correct.
I wonder if you have worked in places with extreme terrain in a way that allowed you to connect in a particular way with Alan's needs and his team's needs.
Well, I was an intel analyst, so I was kind of behind the scenes, so I wasn't hiking the crazy terrain, but I did speak to a lot of infantrymen, those that are out there actually, you know, carrying their rucksacks and hiking crazy mountains in war zones particularly. And they always, same thing, you know, Alan didn't want to mention it, but it was like the crotch would rip out of your pants if you're, you know, you're climbing or getting into vehicles, that constant motion is straining on particular areas of garments where there's semen.
Well, I would think like you're not just taking regular steps like you would on the sidewalk.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. It's
like lunging.
Exactly. So just that constant motion and you're wearing the same garment, you know, maybe for a week, maybe 2 weeks. And so doing that nonstop, it's not getting washed. It's, you know, it's not well maintained. It's causing stress points and then it's going to rip. So that was one of the other things is the pants I designed. I inserted a gusset to help maximize that mobility. But yeah, just the infantry guys, I guess, is kind of where I get feedback from the military. And that's kind of, it's always been in the back of my mind. Like, I understand this is what's happening.
Abby, you mentioned earlier that something for like the outdoors and designing a garment for a really specific kind of situation, that's right up your alley. Why is that? Can you give me the context for that?
So many moons ago, while I would be sitting on guard duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, both places, I would sit there and draw fashion. Usually it was fancy dresses, something really girly because you're wearing a uniform. You know, you can't be feminine out in the field. Which is funny because when I got out of the military, all I could think about was how I can improve the military uniform and equipment that, you know, these guys wear every single day. So I originally got my degree in interior design, went and did that for 5 years. I was passionate about sewing and still designing apparel. So that was actually what made me come back to graduate school, was to do further research in military uniform and apparel or accessory design.
So are you going to go to a volcano so you can wear your own breathable lava suit?
I think that would be ideal. That adds to the user experience, just being a researcher, understanding what your users are going through.
And then how do you top something called a breathable lava suit for your next design?
Oh, shoot. You can have a whole collection. Not every two people are the same. So, you know, you can have 5 different pants and jacket designs. They wear multiple layers out in the field. So there's a whole apparel collection there.
Awesome. Abby Romine, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jenna.
Abby has designed clothing to be worn while studying volcanoes. She joined us from MU, and that is it for today. You can get everything from this morning's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. It'll be ready for you by the end of today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we have a portrait session with an important figure in Kansas City's Black theater scene. Hear the story of Harvey Williams, director of The Melting Pot, tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with lots of help today from intern Riley Kester. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.